Europe is complicated. There was really no way to tell that Austria bordered Germany. There's just no way. Previously in Europe, Boris Johnson.
And welcome to Previously in Europe again for another week. Are we late in this episode, Ciarán? Is this not scheduled correctly?
Yeah, that was my fault. I had a comedy night and I went to it. I'm sorry, guys.
You should be sorry. I'm personally hurt, really, more than anything. It's a personal hurt.
To be honest, I've discussed this with you off mic, and I won't go into too much details, but I was having a conversation after the show that the entire time I was thinking, being like, I wish I was talking to Hugh.
I think what everyone thinks at all times. They're just like, I wish I could be Ciarán, not so that I could live Ciarán's life, but so I could be on a podcast with Hugh.
Not so I could live Ciarán's life, which is mediocre at best.
Hey, you just moved to an exciting new country that we'll talk about later.
We will, yes. It's so exciting.
But first to the quote-unquote headlines, because really, we never just say the headlines. We always talk about it for a bit. So we covered recently the massive anti-corruption protests in Armenia that culminated in, they have a new prime minister now who was a former journalist who was basically the figurehead of the anti-corruption protests. So that's pretty remarkable as a turnaround. But now, more and more, as more stuff is coming out, it does seem that a lot of their complaints were just based, they were just completely factual. There was no kind of, there was a lot less gray area than you would have thought. A lot of the people they were protesting against have now turned out to be wildly corrupt. One of them is,
that's a really common, it's a very predictable conspiracy theory, when the opposition takes over because of supposed corruption charges on the other side.
Yeah.
Oh, look, they're arresting their opposition now. That conspiracy theory is always floated.
Yeah. Whereas this seemed that does happen. Conceivable. But there's now turning out to be an awful lot of a lot of evidence against a lot of these people. Basically, people who are living implausibly beyond the means. That this is the problem with public officials, is that you people know what your salary is, and then realistically,
very public.
Yes, exactly. And it often comes out people have consultancies and stuff on the side, or do speaking tours and stuff on the side. But then when you get down to countries of the size of Armenia, when you're it becomes quite conspicuous when the mayor is living beyond their means, because you're where are you getting the money that isn't embezzlement or massive corruption? I don't think you're going on speaking tours for $20,000 a pop. I find that unlikely for the mayor of Yerevan. Anyway, so
maybe he's going to the wider Armenian speaking world.
Yes. That is the air of when all those books were being published in Azerbaijan suspiciously due to corruption. So including the mayor of Yerevan and then a number of other people seen previously as elder statesmen, I think the thing that's been thrown out is the clear progression of what happened, and this is true of a lot of post-Soviet countries, was that there grew a political elite pretty quickly in the 90s after, when they became independent, and then those people became corrupt in a not particularly short period of time. Is that the way it worked before in a lot of in a lot of those cases, and was kind of entrenched in the Soviet government, that there was corruption of officials, and then when they got replaced with people who took over the systems that were inherently corrupt, and gradually, if the money's just lying there, you take it, you put it in your pockets, and things are looking up. There seems to be some serious prosecutions and stuff. So, we will see.
Yeah, good on them. I think we were when we first covered that that whole popular revolution type thing. We were at parts quick to dampen it and be like, oh, well, wait and see. This has never usually gone well for countries in the immediate vicinity of Russia that have rebellions and protests at large scale. But this might turn out good.
No, yeah.
Good for Armenia.
Yeah, it generally seems to turn out that there's like the figurehead of those things tends to be like someone quite like not tainted, but as in kind of they end up not doing what they said effectively, and you end up with like an improved but not like with its own problem situation. Whereas like the initial signs of this seem to be there might be some actual like I guess cleaning of the system a bit, and see what happens beyond that. But you know, it's the it'd be nice if their problems aren't like massive corruption, but kind of just like poorly run government systems.
Speaking of poorly run governments,
So two of the like main people related to Brexit have resigned from the UK government. David Davis initially resigned. He was the Brexit secretary, so he ran a department that they invented to do Brexit, I guess. And Boris Johnson, the foreign secretary, or kind of like these like the Secretary of State equivalent, I guess, for like the US, I guess, he resigned as well. They were both like big Brexit people in the campaign.
I mean like Boris Johnson has very much resigned as a kind of opportunist of he's still going the appeal to the Brexit vote route. Because his line now, like, correct me if I'm wrong, but the line I've seen coming out of him so far is that, like, oh, the way Brexit, Theresa May is doing Brexit is not what we wanted. It's not going well. And she's, like, portrayed the original vision of Brexit and stuff like that. As if there was ever a coherent one to begin with. But, and, like, so he's basically still trying to court the like these Brexit voters who might not be happy with how Brexit actually turns out, and he's making a new enemy of Theresa May's government of not handling this well.
Yeah, so sort of. He hasn't been super aggressive with it yet because it seems that the like hyper pro Brexit conservative MPs that aren't like in the cabinet because they don't get on. They have come out saying that they're not gonna like try and take that into government over this, but they will like kind of push from the outside using the fact that there's a very very slim majority with the kind of there's no majority, it's a minority government with a confidence supply deal with the DUP. So yeah, it's kind of like it's a more precarious situation than there was previously, but you now don't have the problem of David Davis very frequently would come back from Brussels negotiations saying one thing, and then immediately that would have the opposite would be said from the from Theresa May, because like effectively he was a figurehead without a mandate, because the department was backfilled with people that Theresa May actually liked and got on with and you know had some agreement with. They resigned over there's like now a document that is still very vague, but technically everyone that is now in the cabinet has signed on and agreed to it as their negotiating goals. So like part of the reason that like we haven't talked about Brexit in quite a while, and main reason is because while it still gets news coverage, nothing has happened, and that's because every time they have a negotiation about it, the EU says, what is your actual end goal? What do you envisage happening? And we can discuss that. Then either they say, no, you need to give us ideas, or they say something that's like physically impossible. That is kind of a complete no-go. Either it's like monetarily impossible and that they haven't done the figures correctly, it's physically impossible and not in the realms of like for instance their purely borderless but technology tracked system for the Republic of Ireland, Northern Ireland border. It's like the technology for that doesn't really exist, and I think you've underestimated the logistical problem you'd create if you did that.
I also really enjoyed, I had a slight rant about on Twitter about it, but like the Daily Mail suggesting the whole like 10 mile like DMZ within Northern Ireland. It's the biggest thing about Brexit now at this point is that nothing has come of it. Nothing material has come of it. And now that's noteworthy. Like in itself, that's not noteworthy. It's now noteworthy because it's been so long and nothing has come of it. And we're very closely approaching the supposed, like the deadline has been extended. If the deadline wasn't extended, this would be over very soon.
It's the problem of nobody had an actual plan that would make more than a small group of people happy. So you would get situations where they would suggest something that, like, obviously the EU quite liked, that would be unpalatable to the majority of the government. In the UK, so it would obviously be a complete, like, no-runner. And, like, this effective agreement that they come up with is, like, an agreement for goods, but not an agreement for services. But, like, that's kind of basically something that, like, the EU will say no to. But at least they have now a position that everybody is technically on board with. With this previous situation where it was Theresa May would suggest something like this, and then David Davis would say, I'm not negotiating that. Like, I'm not using that as my that's not what I want out of it, so why would I use that as our negotiating platform? And it's like, well, what you want isn't what the majority of our party wants either, so we need to come up with a compromise. Which the EU is still going to say no to, so it doesn't matter. Like, this effectively is the UK is saying that we think it would be difficult and annoying for us to have not be in a single market for goods, because it would be physically difficult and a logistical problem. We export a lot of goods. We don't have to stop doing that. We import a lot of goods. We don't want that to become complicated. However, they don't want a single market for services, because the UK makes an awful lot of money in services, and they want to be able to prevent services being brought in from abroad. They don't want UK banking to be done from Germany, etc. That's their concern.
Yeah, so basically what we're getting is Italian mozzarella served by Yorkshire waitresses.
That's what we want. But the EU's going to say no to it, so it doesn't matter.
It's been a while since we talked about Brexit, but yes, for a good reason. Not much is happening.
This is the first substantial thing to have happened in quite a while. Previously, it's been like junior ministers resigning, them having summits where nothing happened. The news during the last EU summit was that Brexit wasn't like the main item on the talking points, and it was like, yes, because they specifically said they were talking about migration. I was like, but they're not talking about Brexit, do they have to take it seriously? It's like, well, there's nothing new to say, so I don't know what you think they'd meet about.
I feel like the response to that is the EU weren't handed the same like Brexit portfolio you were handed, journalist. Like, they don't have to talk about it every week, unfortunately.
Well, not unfortunately, I mean, yeah, so. But anyway, speaking of people who try to say no to things but it then just continue in a cyclical problem, the Romanian president, who we've talked about quite a bit on this podcast over the years,
prime minister you should say, right? No, sorry, the president and prime minister. We've talked about the prime minister quite a bit as well.
So last week there was bubbling that, like, there was potentially so the president of Romania really doesn't get on with the actual government, prime minister's party, and they were seriously looking into kind of impeachment proceedings or some sort of like suspension proceedings, because he was refusing to dismiss the lead anti-corruption prosecutor. So there's currently like a big problem of the anti-corruption prosecutor is largely a office that the justice minister is trying to get rid of, neuter in some way, because they're basically just there to put the, you know, current ruling party in prison because of all their corruption.
Yes. Which is, if he was allowed to say that clearly, is a really cool job title.
Right.
Don't think he can be as brazen about it as we can.
No, I don't think you could be like, oh, so what's your job title? I'm a government takedowner.
Yeah, I'm essentially the I'm like a bureaucrat meets the Marvel's Punisher.
Have you seen the film Rambo? So just imagine that, but put it in like a governmental setting,
like a Romanian government rather than, you know, Vietnamese jungle.
So the development this week was that, so the president was trying to block this effectively, because the system is that the justice minister can basically fire people, and then the president has to do it. Or like the president has final say. Like, you can kind of recommend to the president that he dismiss them. And the president was basically like, I'm not doing it. That's why they were looking into, like, how can we get the president to do it? So the remaining constitutional court has found that the president doesn't have discretion to on whether or not they want to dismiss people. They're basically supposed to, like, advise as to whether or not the dismissal is legal. And if it is legal, they're supposed to do it. And if it's not legal, they're supposed to contest it. And in this case, they found that there were no grounds that the president was able to hold it up. This is not ideal, because there was, like, a lot of, like, praise specifically about this prosecutor from the EU, for instance, of, like, they're actually doing the job they're supposed to be doing.
Yeah. I guess we've talked about it many times with the, like, whole anti-corruption thing happening in Romania, but, like, Romania and Bulgaria were let into the EU on the very, very same premise, which is sort out your corruption.
Yeah.
And if you want to see the, like, comparison, it's look at Bulgaria, where they're effectively doing nothing. whereas Romania is going to town on this. And this guy, as, like, the face of this whole process, presumably has a fair amount of popular support, because the whole anti-corruption effort has a lot of popular support in Romania.
Indeed. But, you know, if you can't not fire people as president, I mean, like, what's the point? I guess you can hold up laws and stuff. This is the other thing he's been doing.
I feel like you just described Trump, basically.
Yeah, but it's the opposite of that. Like, this is the thing, in that, like, Trump's known for firing people, and the Romanian president is like, but I don't want to fire people. And the Constitutional Court have been like, no, you have to fire people. Maybe Trump should be president of Romania. I think it would suit him better.
We should swap them.
Yeah, it's much more related to his skill set, apparently.
Why can't the new president of the United States speak English? I don't understand.
And doesn't know anything about the United States government system, really. Well, that wouldn't be different. That's the same.
Anyway, probably one of the bigger stories that happened this week was something in my new homeland, Germany. Germany had some issues today. We've talked about this before, but the new German government is relatively precarious. There was the elections. There was a long period of trying to build a coalition. Not the longest we've ever seen, but long for Germany. They usually form coalitions a little bit quicker than they did before.
Yeah.
So there was some instability with the current government, but wasn't actually with the coalition partners, or what we would think is the coalition partners. It's actually with two parties that a lot of people, especially outside of Germany, forget are actually two separate parties.
Yeah.
Which is the CDU and the CSU. CSU is basically CDU Bavaria version, which is to say more conservative and probably a little bit richer. So the leader of that party, Minister Horst Seehofer, who is the interior minister, as a part of being a part of the government, he's interior minister and leader of the CSU. Yes, he resigned, but actually didn't. He just threatened. He offered his resignation, which doesn't seem like a very strong move, but apparently kicked off this huge chain of events, which results in some weird stuff. So an attempt to keep him together, because if they lose the CSU, then the coalition falls apart, basically.
I think you technically could have the coalition without the CSU, but it would be like a electoral problem basically forever from now on for the CDU. Like, it's kind of an inconceivable thing
they
to
need
do.
Bavaria.
Realistically, they do, yeah.
Yeah, as a party, not necessarily as a coalition, yes.
Yeah, and like an awful lot of people in Merkel's party also agree with him. Like, it's not it's not a situation where, like, the CSU are, like, the only conservative driving force who don't like migration. There's a lot of CDU people who don't like migration, and it's a problem for them, but it's not so much a problem that they would want to get rid of Merkel for it, or that they could, whereas the CSU are separate and therefore ended up with the interior minister. The standoff was quite odd. It was like the interior minister initially was saying that they were thinking they were probably going to resign, and then they said, we'll give Merkel 2 more weeks of an idea, and then 2 weeks passed, and then things kicked off again. And effectively, they've come to an agreement, which seems to basically just be what Seehofer wanted, which is upsetting because it's effectively the exact opposite of what Merkel's previous position was a year ago, and largely what she ran on in the campaign, like, was not this.
Yeah, so this has caused the problems of, like, Merkel as a center-right figure had some, like, I don't know, liberal cred in terms of how she handled some of the things regarding the refugee crisis. At least internationally, I think a lot of people I talk to in Germany says that that's kind of like a lot of smoke and mirrors, and, you know, she's still deporting a lot of people, and it's not as a humanitarian as it might first appear internationally.
Yeah, it was the sheer scale of it ended up with, yes, Merkel's deporting a lot of people, but that is because they are letting in so many people, and it's like an enormous brunt of the, like, total migration into Europe was going to Germany. So, like, while, you know, deporting numbers end up also being incredibly high, you're like, yeah, but the current still total migration in is way bigger than anywhere else.
And this is also the case of, like, a move like this will always kind of appear good when next to what Hungary was doing at the time, or other countries are doing at the time. Yeah, yeah.
That's the thing. She got relative liberal cred.
Relative liberal cred, yes. As sexy a title as that is, she may have lost it all now. Yeah, because she's agreed to this scheme of, like, basically refugee processing centers outside of Germany's borders in neighboring countries, anyone trying to get into Germany. Yeah, this causes problems because you have to make sure that those living conditions are, like, humane. It costs a lot of money to store a lot of people, like, or house a lot of people in, like, in that kind of space.
Yeah.
You also have to do it in your neighboring countries, so this requires, like, a lot of bilateral agreements. Like, Germany considers itself geographically to be Middle Europa, to be, like, the center of Europe.
Yeah.
It borders a lot of countries. I mean, Denmark's probably not an issue, but... that's probably about it. So, like, this is going to be, like... This seems like a ridiculously costly way of doing things, which is also weird. Sebastian Kurz of Austria was also super on board with this. Until he kind of realized that he's a country that borders Germany. So if I'm not mistaken, he's basically said he'll enact Dublin regulation, and he'll basically kick all the refugees that came to his country via Germany back to presumably Italy.
It's basically what ended up happening, which Salvini is obviously not happy about. But then this, you know, gives fuel to Salvini's let's give Libya money and to take people back, and then you end up with the problem of, yeah, but by the time people got, like, most of these people didn't originate in Libya, your idea of send them back to where they came from, you're just sending them, like, one step next. So it's kind of like sending them to Libya, which is not somewhere equipped to handle more refugees, is, like, is an insane idea we'll pay incredibly large sums of money to transport these people to Libya, where we know they won't, you know, have, like, that's where they were before. It wasn't a good situation.
The other side of this is, like, I think we've mentioned before when talking about, like, the Turkey deal and the Libya deal, or the prospect of a Libya deal, is that Libya is still in a state of civil war. What the EU recognizes, the Libyan government does not have 100% control of the country, or even 100% control of the coast. Then there's also just, like, the constant, like, UN and NGO reports coming out that there are, like, open slave markets happening in Libya at the moment. And people will say, like, oh, we shouldn't have overthrown Gaddafi, and maybe the way we, like, that was done was pretty poor, but shit like this was happening under Gaddafi's rule as well, like the quality of refugees, like Berlusconi was personally paying that man to house them
in. The reason there's a precedence for this is because of the years of propping up Gaddafi. Once they stopped propping up Gaddafi and like provided like air support for what was a violent uprising anyway, the Libyan people largely overthrew Gaddafi. Like, it wasn't wasn't like a ground force invasion kind of situation. Well, I mean,
It wasn't like the popular rebellion in Libya wasn't backed by like an idea of we would like to continue doing the exact same thing we've been doing in Berlusconi just without Gaddafi.
No, I don't think that was the rallying cry when they were marching on Gaddafi's palace. They weren't shouting like distribute the money from Italy to the Coast Guard directly instead. I think
more
like
of the same.
Yeah, I think the parallels with the Turkey deal are interesting because it's kind of like the Turkey deal effectively was like. The people who left UN, like, supported refugee camps for the Syrian war, we want you to take them back because they, like, dangerously, illegally entered Greece. And that was that agreement, effectively. It wasn't everybody who goes through Turkey. It was specifically, like, for that situation. Whereas with Libya, it's effectively anyone who happened to travel to Libya to get to Europe, send them back to Libya where we know it's dangerous for them. This isn't like sending them back to a refugee camp elsewhere. This is sending them just back to Libya, which is different. It's not the same thing, and it's neither is great really in my opinion, but this one is worse.
No, absolutely. I think there's just the things we talked about before are just like very much poo-poo the idea out of the gate. Like Merkel's or Erdogan's government is terrible, but he has control of his country. Some would argue maybe too much control of his country.
Yeah, well, I think I would argue that.
Yeah. The other thing we should say about this story is that the Social Democrats, SPD, have agreed to the Merkel and Seehofer migration compromise. So that's kind of fine. They've done it reluctantly because there's very little belief that their membership would actually support this plan. And then on top of that, I think the international damage has been that Seehofer kind of has the party over a barrel. Like he has control of the CDU, which he shouldn't. He represents a smaller party, but I guess your point is correct that like he doesn't necessarily represent a smaller faction of thought within the wider conservative branch of German government.
No, I think this is like a problem people are, when come next German election, when the SPD are again, they end up with someone like Schulz, effectively, who has like a lot of good progressive sounding ideas, and then is shocked when everyone doesn't get on board with them and can't see that it's possibly the technocrat who came back from the European Parliament. We don't really want him to lecture us on social programs. And like fixing the problems of globalization, if you've just come from working at the EU Parliament, I don't really why isn't this working? That it'll be a similar thing of like, oh, like your migration rhetoric is fine, but didn't you back like really a really morally questionable transit center system? Wasn't that like, didn't you greenlight that personally? Will be the what will end up with the situation. It'll be the same thing of, oh, all the people on the left in Germany aren't riled up for this campaign. It's like, yes, what have you seen your candidate? What?
Does that mean that Reddit isn't an accurate representation of German people?
Oh dear,
that was a hot minute, wasn't it?
It was certainly a minute.
Yeah.
Okay, and now we're gonna do a topic that I've been teasing for teasing for months and have been avoiding talking about it until I had enough time to actually read up on it properly.
You saw the teaser trailer, you saw the first trailer, you saw the second trailer where we revealed that Quicksilver is going to be in this one.
Wait, what are you talking about? No, we're talking about Trade Wars.
Yeah, Trade Wars.
Okay.
It's been bad ever since Disney bought it.
Quicksilver's in this one. It's what we call really expensive steel. Yeah, so this is two separate but related things that are both, like, effectively, like, U.S. foreign policy that have just become, like, complicated EU trade policy problems that are, yes, related but also super not related. It just depends on the whims of whoever is shouting the loudest at the time, which gets more attention. And also one of them is slower moving than the other, but, you know, anyway. So we'll start off with the one that's been, like, persistent and just trickling out slowly. Mm-hmm. So savvy people who listen to the U.S. president speak at one point might have noticed that he talks about Iran a lot.
Heard this before.
Like, the Iran deal was the worst deal ever negotiated, etc., etc., because John mm-hmm. Kerry did it, and therefore it's evil.
Yes. I think he thinks Obama did it, though.
Yeah, I don't think he remembers who John Kerry is. Anyway, the Iran deal effectively, like, boiled down to they would get rid of most of the economic sanctions on Iran, and then lots of business would be happening in Iran, and their economy would do better, because they're starting to have... Now, anytime there's protests in Iran, people jump on, is this a revolution? Are people going to take down the government? Is it regime change? And it's usually, like...
Say it's regime change. I so want it to be regime change.
Yeah. It's usually, like, economic protests, because there are economic problems in Iran and, like, importing problems. Mm-hmm. And kind of... They, like a lot of other places, have, like, you know... middle class job shortages and stuff. It's like it's a real problem. So this was, like, the big thing of the Iran deal was, like, well, this, you know, in a few years it'll start to fix these problems. And all they had to give up for it was their nuclear program, which, I mean, what's this? I mean, that's not really, do you need a nuclear program if, like, everyone agrees no invading?
I thought you were gonna say it's like, do you need a nuclear program where everyone agrees that you are a terrible country and need to be invaded? Yeah, probably.
Yeah, but this is the thing. If you have a piece of paper signed that says that totally no invading and we won't build nukes, that sounds fine. As long as there's economic improvements. So the problem with this is that now that Trump is president, he's decided that the Iran deal doesn't work. But I really think that from his initial perspective when he was talking about it, it was kind of the US has negotiated a bad deal with Iran, whereas while mm-hmm. the US was one of, like, the forerunners and, like, is obviously one of the big players in the agreement, the EU is also an enormous part of the Iran deal. Mm-hmm. And really, realistically speaking, like, a lot of the actual initial economic benefit, other than, like, direct sanctions that the US had, like the lifting of embargoes and trade restrictions, a lot of that benefit was going to be from EU companies or multinationals yes. based in the EU or people operating elsewhere in the Middle East who are friendly to the US. Like, there were benefits from the US sanctions, but kind of the EU was also an enormous fish, and they actually want to do business in Iran because, you know, business, there's money to be made there. There's people with money that will need goods and services.
I think the slightly more serious point there is that, like, Iran is slightly more is of slight more economic importance to Europe mm-hmm. than it is to the United States. Iran is quite far removed from the United States,
yeah,
in the grand scheme of things, whereas, like, Iran is quite a big deal for this whole, like, Silk Road project that like is happening between China and the EU and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Iran has its place in the wider economic stage. It's just not as US oriented as people might suspect or think based on how Trump talks about it.
No, it's very easy to think of Iran as a country that exports oil and nothing else. but like, it's also a country with lots of other stuff going on. It's not like Iran and Saudi Arabia are very different places.
Very different. Like Iran, Iran very much has a, from what I've seen in comparison between it and Saudi Arabia, very much has a functioning, more well-rounded economy.
Yes. Yeah.
The problem with Saudi Arabia is it's very dependent on oil, and like oil is all there is. And that's an exaggeration, obviously, but Iran, due to being relatively isolated, has been producing a lot of its own stuff for a very, very long time, or has to become a bit more independent than Saudi Arabia did. So there was Iran has been making more stuff.
Yeah, but also prior to direct sanctions and whatnot, Iran had an economy. Like it is a very, very large, it's a large country with, you know, an actual economy that needs that needs to do international trade and have stuff going on. So the plan now from the EU is basically that they think that the deal can work without the US, is that renegotiating it, the deal is already unpopular with a lot of very hardline Iranian people, so making it increasing inspections, etc., there's nothing that would satisfy effectively Trump's government. There's no renegotiating it realistically. Please prove me wrong, but I don't think anything like that is going to happen. So the EU's plan is effectively that not all European businesses are active in the US and the Middle East. Lots of European businesses are active in Europe and the Middle East, and you could just do business in euros, and they could do all the stuff that they were planning on doing, development loans via the EU's development bank and just not via the US, and don't use dollars effectively, and that you will just avoid US sanctions if it's just US sanctions. And then Tehran would agree to adhere to a nuclear deal. However, Iran's pretty, shady on this because, one of the big things was US sanctions. And if the US is able to strong arm big multinational companies to not operate in Iran, that's a big downside, realistically.
Yes.
If it's a trade embargo, which is, the way that generally works is you can't do business in the US if you do business in Iran, that's such a negative that it might make the thing not work at all. And also there's the problem of the US is actively trying to prevent this situation, where the EU could just say that's fine, you pulled out of the agreement, but we'll keep the agreement in place. They seemingly want to really, really put pressure on it for I don't know what end goal, because the agreement they got was pretty much what you would expect them to get. It's it's better than any agreement they're going to get with North Korea, so I don't really understand what the end goal is, unless they want Iran to become so dangerous they have to invade them.
That might be what they want.
But yeah, that's what is the thing. That's probably is what they want.
The good Iran deal, because you're right, I feel like you're right, and again, I agree with you, prove me wrong, of there isn't some sort of small tweak you can do to the Iran deal that will appease Trump and his followers in this idea. The good Iran deal in Trump's head is the Iran deal, but with Norway or something, a country he likes.
Yes. Yeah. It's that it's with Iran, or don't do a deal with a lot of their public criticisms of it are things there's not enough inspections, and it's there's a lot more, there's more inspections than you would often, a lot of these historical agreements of these situations, and there's, I don't know what inspection regime you would actually impose, because the danger was, Iran could start making a weapon again, and they would have it in a few years, but the alternative was they were probably going to have one by now, was a lot of people's predictions.
Yeah.
So it didn't, this is better than what the previous situation was. And also, invade them with capitalism. I don't know. That just seems if you're going to have to invade them, that just seems a better way to do it.
Oh, totally, yeah, because, like, I don't know how many, like, war nerds there are out there listening, like, the kind of people who are really into the history of war and, like, war statistics and logistics and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Iran's a fucking nightmare.
Yeah.
In terms of, like, a ground invasion. Like, I think most people in their heads a lot of the times envision Iran as, like, a deserty place. Because mm-hmm. that's, like, what a lot of Middle Eastern countries are like, supposedly. No, it's, like, rainforest, mostly mountains.
Yeah.
There are also deserts. There's, like, there are no clothes you can pack that prepares you for all of Iran.
No, Iran is large and be very difficult to invade.
They have ski slopes. They're the skiing destination of, like, Western Asia.
Yes, it's a complex place that is confusing and has a lot going on.
It's a meat grinder. If you were just to do a war there, it would be an absolute... And they are armed to the teeth as well, because they have been... I don't know if you know anything about Iranian politics, but they've been suspecting a US invasion for quite some time.
That's largely the basis of the regime, and which is why, like, what the US actually wants is, what the current US government wants is regime change. Mm-hmm. But, like, I don't think that's the way to go about it isn't, like, was this. This was the way to go about it, was... cool, we're gonna have the economic situation will improve, but it'll be via westernization, which you've railed against as, like, the greatest evil, and mm-hmm. you've now just agreed to something that would, like, gradually allow for it. So
yeah,
I don't know what the long-term other, like, alternative to this is, other than wait until they get nuclear weapons so you can invade, you can, or, like, they're about to, so you can make a case to invade them, which mm-hmm. I don't know what the end goal of that is. Like, that's also a short-term fix.
Well, yeah, it's, well, the end term, well, the end goal of that, whether intended or not, will be another war that will just go on forever and ever and ever, like Afghanistan and Iraq, except now all three of them will be joined.
Mm-hmm.
One contiguous border of three nations thrown into chaos. Yay.
Yeah. Anyway, so enter the new-ish German ambassador from the US. The US ambassador to Germany, Richard Grenell. Grenell? Grenell. I can't. I find on this podcast we just can't pronounce anyone's name, regardless. Like, even if they're like someone of a Western name or like an Anglo-Saxon name, I'm still like, now that I've said it out loud, it sounds wrong.
Richard Granolabar.
Yes, Richard Granolabar. So initially, when, like, Trump first initially said that they were pulling out of the Iran deal, the quote from him that he tweeted was, "German companies doing business in Iran should wind down operations immediately." Nice. And, like, this was around when he was appointed. That was quick. Mm-hmm. And, like, since then, like, the main other thing that he's known for is last month in June, he gave a interview to Breitbart, the, like, hyper right-wing online outlet, where he said, "I absolutely want to empower other conservatives throughout Europe, other leaders," which implies that other, like, conservative, like right-wing people should contact him so he could help them via his, like, influence as German ambassador. Well, I think he's misunderstood what the point of an ambassador is. It's so that he can, like, be their representative with the German government. It's not to, like, say that I will make good contacts with, like, our political allies in Germany who may or may not be in government or other people in other countries.
I think he, I think someone handed the, like, talking points to the wrong people. So, like, Michael Bolton got, like, diplomacy, and this granola bar got regime change.
Yeah. Yeah, you got the wrong wrong packet in the morning. It was just like, "I'm saying this in the interview? Okay, well, you say so."
"We don't agree with Germany's nuclear program." What?
Yeah, no, I and like it, like, there's no reason why this guy wouldn't know that that's would go down badly with the German government. His previous career was he was the director of communications and public diplomacy for the United States UN mission. He was in that job for 7 years.
So he wasn't, presumably wasn't terrible.
He was, so he was in the UN when George W. Bush had to get had to get people on board of for his invasions, which he seemed to do successfully because a lot of people helped them invade places. So I don't understand how he's gone from that to being like publicly saying, "Oh, if you want regime change in your if you're on the right and you don't like the government of your country, contact me. I'll help you out."
Yeah. Dial 555-555 column.
Martin Schulz, who everyone remembers as a terrible, terrible candidate, said, "What this man is doing is unheard of in international diplomacy." Which, yes, yeah, well, I guess reasonable.
I'm just checking if the subreddit The Schulz still exists. Maybe there's some people who don't remember him as a terrible candidate.
Like he gave the counterexample, which is this is basically akin to if the German ambassador in Washington came out and said, "I endorse the Democratic candidate for president," or "I think I'd like any Democrats who want political help like to boost their international status, come talk to me." Like, that's effectively what he's doing, which is baffling. But then on top of that, there have been reports of him directly contacting like German businesses operating in Iran, saying that if they either don't start or wind down operations in Iran, he can be their conduit to help them do business in the US instead. Which is like, again, for the guy who seemed to be like the concern initially was like when Trump got into power was he's gonna give loads of his cronies jobs, like sweet ambassador jobs. Like the ambassador to Germany, that's a pretty good ambassadorship. Give it to one of his like weird insider people, but he just gave it to like a gross Republican career like foreign policy guy who you think would have more I don't know, not like respect for the way international diplomacy normally goes, but more like not riling up people and not basically being like, "Oh, your like country's stated goals, I'm gonna like intentionally subvert them while I'm here." Don't revoke my status.
So basically, like, you're right. The initial concern was that Trump was just going to give all these like positions to like his weird crony like business friends.
Yeah, which he seems to have done as well.
Oh, it's totally. Yeah, but that's not like it's not happening. Mm-hmm. It's just the implicit fear was that like they wouldn't be good at their job.
Yeah.
They would cause diplomatic incidents.
Yeah, yeah. You were like, don't put inexperienced people in the State Department was a big concern. They were like, all the good State Department people who like know how diplomacy works, they're all quitting. It was like, some of them are still around, either just terrible.
What you're meant to do in politics is get the like career guy who has been working at this career, and he's maybe a bit smarmy, but he respects the process. Like,
yeah.
Whoops.
Yeah.
Maybe you should have just made like one of your business friends, like the ambassador in Germany. Who knows? They might have been good.
But this is the thing. I think that's this. They would have done this.
Yes, probably. Yes.
This is like it's like he's getting advice from Trump's creepy business people.
The whole world has been turned upside down. Maybe like a string of failed restaurant like businessmen might have actually been really good ambassadors. Maybe they just missed their calling.
Yeah, maybe. How many failed casino people just happen to be really good at international diplomacy? They just really like casinos.
Yeah. Are they be really fun diplomats?
Well, would they, or they be sleazy, creepy diplomats?
Where it's just like, let's talk about the diplomatic issues between our two countries while also playing Texas Hold'em.
I mean, that's like dangerously close to reality anyway.
Yeah, that's fair. Why weren't they perfect shoo-ins at the job, Hugh? I don't understand.
Maybe, you know, again, maybe they are. So the EU to counter this is trying to bring back what they tried to do in the 90s and then ended up not having to do because they just worked it out, you know, on like a bilateral level. So to counter the EU Cuban embargo and some other the US Cuban embargo and some other trade embargoes they had implemented at the time that the EU was saying were not like legal. The Cuban embargo definitely was never, no one but the US ever thinks that was a good idea. It's constantly like brought up at the UN as like a massive injustice. Anyway, so to get around that, the EU basically made it illegal for EU-based companies to adhere to US sanctions if they like negatively impacted like anybody in the EU. This would effectively be like if you were if you wanted to import Cuban cigars and then your like shipping company based in the EU said we're not shipping them because we don't get hit by the sanctions the US would put on us, the EU was basically saying like you can't use that, as you can't do that, that's illegal now as well. We're reverse sanctioning you. It's unclear as to how this would actually work because they never actually had to do it. But the laws are on the books, so they're trying to the commission is looking into amending these to include the current recurrent US Iran sanctions. And it's very unclear as to what the end goal of this would be, but you know, potentially wacky. The other half of this is just an actual like straight up trade war. The US initially were like there's gonna be steel tariffs in the EU because they import too much cheap steel.
Boo.
Yeah, and then Trump goes on about the German car industry a lot, and then for a while they were like the EU's exempt for a while, and then they were like that's expired, they're not exempt anymore. So this is kind of becoming a World Trade Organization hubbub, and the EU has announced a list of billions of euros worth of stuff that they will tax, including like bourbon, which I'm annoyed about. I love me some bourbon. I don't want it to be more expensive. It's already relatively expensive.
Yeah. We'll go underground and we'll make whiskey in bathtubs. It'll be great.
I don't want to live in that world. And I can't buy enough corn to make my corn-based liquors. Yeah. Like a lot of this is agricultural stuff that gets sent in from the US, and the thinking behind this is the same thing as China is doing to counter it. So like this is kind of starting to fly a bit under the radar, the EU aspect of the trade war effect, because China is upping the ante so much and so specifically.
Like the other side of that as well is that I imagine that story feeds into like the relative panic about China that has existed for the last couple of decades of they're going to overtake us.
Yes.
Of thing.
That's true. It fits better into like a broader narrative, whereas like logical circles of the EU imports too much cheap steel into, or exports too much cheap steel into the US, and then the US car manufacturers will turn around and say, no, the EU sends us really high quality expensive steel that we need for so specific parts and that we can't get elsewhere. But both the EU and China are targeting effectively like largely agricultural goods. The big one in China is soybeans, because they have viewed this largely accurately that a large chunk of like core Trump support is in rural areas that depend on stuff like soybean exports, which is a problem of like the middle America states that are highly agricultural, that are very pro-Trump, that are going to be hit most specifically, whereas like nobody is talking about, you know, US services or like taxes on internet companies and stuff that benefits the coasts and the liberal elite, or taxing like the New York Times coming in. it's all that stuff. And like the big thing relating to the EU was that Harley Davidson announced that they were going to move some of the production that was going to be like bound for the EU anyway, just they're going to produce that somewhere else, probably the EU. I forget exactly where they announced, but this is a big thing of Harley Davidson moving jobs abroad. Yes, yeah. Because you made it disadvantageous monetarily, and you exist in a weird, terrible system where everyone has shareholders, and it doesn't. It's stupid.
Yeah, I was looking forward to the possibility of like a whole bunch of like really far right conservatives and like nationalists in the United States like destroying their Harley Davidson in like an uploaded Twitter video to show their rage, like they did with those like coffee machines.
That was the best.
That was the best. But I think Harley Davidson is like in the tens of thousands to get one.
Yeah, I know Harley Davidsons are very expensive motorcycles, but I think the other thing of it was like the way people made that palatable was just, well, oh no, Harley Davidson are just like, this is terrible, but like they're not like moving all their production abroad or anything. It was like, yeah, but they are closing like a plant that will make a lot of people redundant, and they're not closing it because they're making less Harley Davidsons or automation or anything. It's they're very specifically opening a new plant somewhere else.
Yeah, so it's, and like you can't turn to the people who've been like laid off from that plant and be like, don't worry.
Yeah.
The overall effect on jobs hasn't been that great.
Yeah, it's just your job, and Harley Davidson are a savvy company, so like their share price is unaffected, and therefore if you happen to own Harley Davidson stock, that's fine.
Aren't you glad the company will long outlive you and be prosperous without you? Why aren't you smiling? Stop crying.
Yeah, so that's the our rundown of the trade war, quote unquote, plus Iran deal nonsense that, and the way it's affected Europe in kind of a tangential way. It's largely affected, like, Trump's beef seems to be largely with Germany. It's like his shtick this week in the NATO summit has been, oh, Germany's a, because of Nord Stream 2, Germany's a puppet of Russia because it's building a pipeline that provides, like, they're getting all their fuel from Russia. And you're like, sure.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to him saying like something like we have great pipelines, the best pipelines in America, and then just immediately cut to like the Dakota Pipeline Defenders footage, just being like brutally beaten by the police. That would just be brilliant. But yeah, I feel like the story of the EU sanctions has fallen into the wayside, and like why Trump included really focuses on like German cars.
Yeah.
Is because that's something people understand. Like, people know German cars. Like, they're famous companies. But I think a lot of the companies that come out of Europe that, like, a lot of the wider world is, dependent might be the wrong word, but, like, very much suckling at the teat of these industries are not sexy industries, and they're possibly not, like, direct-to-consumer industries either.
No, certainly not. Like, there's a lot of, especially German companies, there's an awful lot of B2B telecommunications companies, or those like big companies that just make a lot of stuff. like companies like Philips, who just make a lot of, they make a lot of products. You can't, like, you, they make it, they make them everywhere. It's not
Siemens.
Like a, yeah,
Siemens,
like places that, like, they have plants in the US, they employ an awful lot of US people, and it's kind of trivial to pick on stuff like, oh, German car manufacturers, because they make the majority of their cars in Germany. But like, as it turns out, that's also often not true. Like, a lot of German car manufacturers do make stuff in the US or assemble things in the US, because shipping stuff like cars, like having all your cars as an import industry, would be, your cars would be way more expensive anyway. So it's kind of you end up picking like odd things to target.
It just seems very reminiscent of like when we talked about one of the companies that was like leaving Catalonia after the independence referendum. It's like one of the biggest companies in Catalonia was a company that made like the equipment necessary to efficiently build like motorways. And they're like, when you're told that, you're like, oh yeah, I guess that would be a big company.
Yeah. I can see why you need a lot of people just to do that.
Yeah. But like, it's not Spotify. It's not something that like will get average Joe excited about or that they're familiar with.
No, it's just kind of like I'd never heard of this company before, so why is it important that like they're being taxed more? Whereas if you're like, you see a lot of German cars around, or like you have heard vaguely that like steel is less of a big industry in the US, where is all the steel coming from? Is really obvious and easy to connect the dots. Whereas stuff like the people who manufacture or plan out motorways.
Liechtenstein's massive denture industry.
Yes, no, for sure. that's what people in the EU should be complaining about more. Like, Liechtenstein need to join up with the program and get on the EU train, because they've ran the dentures market for too long.
That and apparently cat food.
That's odd and Confusing.
Doesn't it sound like a terrible smelling country?
Wait, what are they making the cat food out of?
Old tin chains.
I'm ending this podcast.
That's fair. Previously in Europe is recorded and produced by Hugh O'Brien and Kieran Dold. If you like the show, tell your friends about it. That kind of stuff really helps. And if you've done that, and that's been great, thank you very much, leave us a review. Lots of podcasting apps have a review function. Chances are the one you're using to listen to this podcast has a review function. If so, do that. If not, iTunes is always a good bet. That'd be great. We have a website, previouslyineurope.eu. There you can find links to all our various social medias. We're on Twitter, at PrevInEurope. We are on Facebook. Just search for the Facebook group Previously in Europe, and you can ask to join us. And if you don't look like a bot, we'll let you in. It'll be great. We can chat about stuff. Yay. If you have any news about your country and some weird stuff happening there, email us, previouslyineurope@gmail.com. And to answer a later, earlier question that I had in the podcast, the last post on the R. Schultz was 6 months ago. 6 months ago. That was the last time anyone posted to the subreddit, The Schultz. Thanks for listening.